This program has been brought to you by Cider Week New York City, happening November 6th through 15th, 2015. For more information, check out ciderweeknyc.com.
Hey, this is Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. We recorded a special cider show for Cider Week NYC, and you're going to listen to it live on Heritage Radio Network.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is a special on location at Wassail on the Lower East Side. You've got Ben Sandler and Dan Pucci from Wassail and special guest cider maker John Reynolds of Black Duck Cidery in Ovid, the Finger Lakes, New York, and of course, Gang K from United States of Cider. Thanks to our sponsor, Union Beer Distributors, supplier of world-class ales and ciders. And here we are. It's Wassail. It's a pleasure to be here, man. Last time I was here was your preview night. You guys were just opening, and Sabine and Ben. Tell me what it's like. I mean, I know from our perspective, from doing the show, it seems like every time you have a cider maker in, we do an interview with them. So it seems like a very ambitious program. You've had guys like Kevin Zielinski coming in from Oregon. You know, give us a little background on why you're doing such ambitious programming at a wine bar and cider bar downtown.
Well, why are we doing such ambitious programming? I think that's just integral to who we are, what we're about. I mean, we're about promoting cider. We're about putting cider right to the forefront of our identity. So part of that is inviting some of the movers and shakers and the real rock stars in the world of cider here. And I think they all kind of want to be here, too, which is why you've been meeting
super
a lot of
special
new people lately.
And so, Bing, what got you involved in this? I know you'd worked on Green Markets at one point, Cider Week for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I think helping to develop the market for cider and, more importantly, meeting all of the cider makers that I was working with, even though, you know, it wasn't a big national group still, it just, I felt incredibly motivated to try to create a place in which we could really expand that market opportunity for them. And then also, I think education is a really important component for us at Wassail. Like, we really wanted to leverage our relationships and really try to educate people about this beverage, because it's still a pretty new category for a lot of people.
And you guys even have a cider director. So Dan Pucci, how are you, man?
I'm good. I throw my two cents into that comment. I think that the market really wants to have some place to talk about cider. And I think that cider is really an exciting thing to talk about. And I think that people in the city here really interested in trying new and exciting products from around the country.
Just like we're opening now, which is a great part of being at Wassail. And how did you become a cider director? I mean, what was your background?
I worked in wine before this for many years, and cider is just wine with the wrong fruit. So it's just really easy to kind of translate everything you know from winemaking and wine production into wine and everything into cider. It's the same thing at the end of the day. Cider was always really interesting to me. It was really exciting. It was really fun. And to me, it's great to work with all these great producers like John. Directly, and to work with their products and to kind of help turn market on to great things he's doing.
Great, man. And John, thanks for coming down. So you're from Black Duck Cidery in the Finger Lakes.
True.
And you're in town. What did you do at Wassail last night?
I ate really good food and drank really good cider. I'm not going to lie. and Wassail has been great for us because it... when I first sent them samples... they've been really receptive to our cider and...
Way more than receptive.
Well, okay. That's an understatement.
We were blown away. I mean, the first time we tasted these ciders in the basement during construction, and we were literally like, holy shit, where is this coming from? It was definitely like every time people ask me this question all the time, what's most exciting to you right now in the world of cider? I always say Black Duck.
Yeah, these are...
And the Finger Lakes, specifically.
Yeah, no, that is very humbling. And I will say that really, for me, I'm an orchardist that, you know, happens to make cider. Because my real love is in the orchard. I like touching the trees, you know. I would prefer, in some ways, to always just be in the orchard. Although I like making cider, I'm not going to lie. Yeah, it is sort of a secondary thing.
Yeah. And I think to work with these kind of, work with these ciders and have so much character and like life to them, and like, it's just really amazing.
And tell us about the first cider that we're drinking. Is that Black Duck?
Yeah, that one I first poured was the
Black Duck, the Spanish style Sidra.
So this is, it's a Sidra, and I love Asturias and in northern Spain and the Basque region. I love those Sidras, the ciders that come from those regions. I don't have a lot of the varieties that they use, so I use sort of varieties that English and French and American varieties, sort of to mimic it, but what I do is I make it in a similar style. So when we press the cedar up, it's over multiple days. So it's sitting in the press, which is traditional there, and it gives it a different sort of profile than if you just extracted it right away. If you grind the apples and you press them, you get a totally different sort of beast. And all of these are naturally fermented. So there's yeast and bacteria and all kinds of microorganisms that work on these that I basically have limited control over what they're doing. So every year it's going to be different. There are some similarities, I think, that go through from year to year, but that's sort of the thing. When you work with the natural yeast, you're sort of on a tightrope. You know, you don't really know what's going to happen, and sometimes I do fall off, but that's why we make vinegar also.
I think in the old days, was cider vinegar worth more than cider?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if that was true, but it was definitely valuable, and I really like making vinegar also. That is not an ego-driven thing. I mean, in the cider world, I think that's why there's less people in the cider world that make vinegar, because there's no glory in that. But I really enjoy making vinegar as much as I do cider in some ways. And vinegar really is the end process, or the end product. Cider is just that middle point that you got to try to hold it at. It all wants to be vinegar.
Good man. Welcome to the show. It's a nice start. And you guys join in. So let's just do some tasting notes on it. Dan, what do you like about this?
I love how savory the cider is, and how it has this kind of cool salinity to it, and salt, but at the same time has this all about this nice, like, it's really secondary and really savory. Like, it's not fruit forward. It's definitely all about this kind of like savory, kind of animal quality to the whole thing. It's really pretty cool. It's really fascinating.
What do you think, Kay? Kay's like our expert taster.
I don't know about that, but I sure do like to taste. No, it definitely has that sort of savory thing you can really chew on this cider. You know? It's complex. I get sort of kind of like this warming spice thing from it, too. Like, just like cinnamon. Not in a sweet way, just in a, like, that kind of pleasing heat that it leaves kind of in your mouth after you drink it. And, it is acidic because it's a cedra. It's, it's a cedra style, we should say. We don't want to offend the Spanish by calling it cedra. But it's there, and yet it's all very well balanced, and you could really drink a lot of this.
Oh, yeah. We've got to have more, too. So, Gabe, look, we were here. We've been how many episodes? 10 or 14 episodes
at least.
Cider, all from Wassail's great tasting list.
Absolutely.
And now we're
John
here.
Bunker.
I think the sound here is actually really great, too. I mean, it's a special place. Like I said, I was here for the preview and I haven't been able to come back, but it's a real great place, and you guys did a great job. And it's kind of like you're on Orchard Street. It's kind of this like the new Orchard Street with some new restaurants. And tell us, why did you pick this? And I know you have some plans for Cider Week, too, for some kind of like special street market or something.
Yeah, I mean, Orchard Street is definitely experiencing some kind of it's gone through many, many different turns through its history. It's got a long history, that as people know. And now I think that there's a lot of great activity with chefs and moving in, and a lot of galleries around here. And it's really becoming, the nightlife is kind of changing. It used to be sort of known as more of a kind of party central kind of thing. And I think that, people are getting a little bit more mature now, and it's the area is changing differently. So that was something that we picked up on, and why we chose to be here. Of course, we love the name as well, Orchard Street. It was, not a 100% accident, but it was, definitely, a nice coincidence. And we feel that there's a real kind of history of the rock and roll and the punk scene down here, and we feel like there's this new beginning and regeneration happening all the time, and this is kind of what we're about. We're about defining this new category of what cider is, and we're basically we get to be part of that conversation now and talk about how you drink it, what you eat with it, what how you talk about it, what language you use, and so that's in a nutshell.
So when you guys have John, cider makers like John here from the Finger Lakes, what are some things that you want to learn from him? And you have your tastings and your dinners. It's a really ambitious program.
Well, I mean, go ahead, Dan.
I just want to know more about production. There's only so much I can communicate over email. I really want to know more about his methods and his production styles and how they really grow and treat the fruit. And so I think in talking to him about the stuff, I can then translate that to the guests. I think one of the best things about cider is the connection to New York State and to the people who hear us. Coming from somebody who works in wine before, I used to always say this wine comes from this place in France, it's amazing, but it comes from this place you've been to maybe once, maybe never. With cider, it's it's from the Finger Lakes. Oh yeah, my aunt lives there. Or it's from the Berkshires. Cool, yeah, my aunt, yeah, somebody else lives there too.
and
people have a really nice connection. People can really visualize and connect to these places and where they're from, and people get apples. Grapes are a little more mysterious.
So the first part of that, so tell us about your fruit and the practices.
Yeah, well, we originally planted the first orchard. We actually have two orchards that are within 3 miles of each other there in the Finger Lakes. And the first orchard was about 15 years ago we started to plant it. So we planted, a mix of sort of American varieties of apples that are dual purpose. They could be cider, but also, were for eating out of hand. And then a lot of French and English cider apples. But the big thing we planted was peri pears. Most of those were English varieties. And we planted those very early, which less folks have planted. And then, like I said, this was 15 years ago. And when I started to plant these things that cannot really be eaten out of hand, they can only be made into cider, I was told I was crazy. Because at that point, there wasn't, a lot of knowledge about it or demand for cider like it is now. So we planted quite a mix there. We originally planted the home orchard, and then we bought another parcel and we started to plant that. We do use organic methods in our orchard, although we're not certified. We're going to pursue certification. And our orchard's sort of a mix of, a modern system of high-density dwarf trees. So these are almost grown like grapes on trellis wires. And then also I do have freestanding trees, semi-dwarfs, that look more like sort of the orchards of old that people would know. And I kind of prefer the dwarf system. And I come out of a background of fruit science. I was at Cornell. So I take what I think is the best of that world and then also what I think is the best of sort of the old world techniques, and I try to blend it together. But that's sort of really my style. But I think the pears are the craziest thing, the peri pears, because some of those took 11 years from planting till they had fruit.
That's crazy.
And that's why you don't have people planting a lot of them, because you, as Dan said, you would have to be crazy to do that. And we continue to put more acres in of peri pears. We're going to have 7 acres.
So you're admitting you're crazy?
Well, right. I think
she wants to only find. Yeah. She means if you're not crazy, you can't come to us. Yeah.
Well, isn't there some lore about planting pear trees basically for the next generation?
You plant
it's
pears
not for yourself.
Your yeah. No, and it's yeah. that's and there's a. I mean, I found out why that saying is true, because we used to always say that, but you don't really realize till you yourself. 11 years. I will say, my wife, yes, has said that I'm clearly crazy, and 10 years into the pear, she asked why we weren't cutting them down and just making firewood at that point. Because she thought for sure they were never going to fruit at that point. And I was starting to doubt myself. But they have now started to fruit, and I do continue to plant more, and I do have two beautiful young daughters that maybe someday will benefit from my craziness.
You know, Tom Oliver from England, who makes great perry, he says he wants a perry tree to be 50 years old to make really good perry out of. So
I hope that's two generations. I hope that's true. I hope those trees, you know, are 50 years old, 100 years old. And yeah, those old trees in England and France are just amazing. Some of them, you know, I've been told in Normandy, some of the trees I saw were 200 years old. They're massive, tall trees that just are beautiful and amazing, and they do make, yeah, I think, amazing perry. So, yeah, I hope our trees are 200 years old someday, which, right, is many generations down the road.
I just wanted to say, you know, I feel like this kind of conversation about making people understand the agricultural connection to what cider is so important, because a lot of people still think cider is brewed and don't really understand, you know, what is required really to grow the fruit and to take care of the fruit. And so we, you know, we find that that's a really important thing. And that's one of the reasons why we love bringing cider makers here to interact with the public, and why we have, you know, the educational programs we do, and why Dan, with his wine background and training, you know, talks about the cider and the taste and style profiles in a certain way that reinforce that connection. And we added, you know, these kind of notes underneath the ciders that will help the guests kind of navigate that themselves too, which is exciting.
That's brilliant. This is a great start to the show. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
You're listening to Touching the Surface by Dreams.
L. Knife & Son acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn, but has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Union Beer has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Kings County, Brooklyn, through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education on all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the 14 counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
This is Clay Gordon of thechocolatelife.com, and you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is a special on location at Wassail on the Lower East Side, one of our great cider shows here. And Ben and Dan and Sabine from Wassail, K&K from United States of Cider, and John Reynolds from Black Duck Cider. We're drinking some great stuff, talking about perries and stewardship of land. And John, tell us about this dry perry, because it's I'm digging it, man. I love your stuff.
Thank you very much. I think this one is the 2014, and I think this is a little different than the 2013 that we had originally brought here to Wassail. And I think part of that is last year we had a light crop on true perry pears and some of the cider apples themselves. And that was mainly because I learned a valuable lesson in 2013, and that's you really do need to thin these fruits off the tree more than I did. You know, there was always talk that you could have minimal care for cider and perry fruits compared to dessert fruit because, you know, appearance and things like that didn't matter, and that's true. but you still need to thin these down or these trees want to go completely biennial. So last year I had a very light crop, and so it was a good, you know, lesson for me to learn, even though I've been doing this for a long time. You never are too old to learn something. So this year the crop looks really great. This one is a mix of several Perry varieties and then a couple Old American varieties like Seckle and Honey Sweet, but there's a Barnett in this and gin and brandy Perry pears. And this year we should have the full complement again, which is about 15 different types of Perry pears. Mm-hmm. So I think it will be this. I consider this a little bit lighter than what the 2013 is, not as dense, is sort of what that one was. I still like it, but it is different. Yeah, mm-hmm. And it sort of shows the vintage variation of apples, much like grapes.
So. Yeah, actually, for a Perry, I find it that would be one of the more fuller-bodied Perrys I've ever had. And you say it's lighter than your previous ones?
I believe it is.
Yes. I believe you. I haven't tasted it.
Yeah. Lighter than last year's?
Last year's was so viscous and textured and like...
God, I remember it being lighter last year's, actually. Really? A little bit more tannic, a little bit more...
Last year's was...
Way more savory, like vegetal, like full-on celery. This one still has, great, great celery, notes. Like, I feel like I'm just kind of chewing on the celery leaves, mm-hmm. but... yeah, I think this one's a little bit chewier.
Who else in New York is making Perry's?
Eves makes a Perry.
So how is Eves different from this?
They make a blend of...
theirs is much more, I think, has more dessert fruit in it.
I would say it's...
In America,
fruitier. There's fruitier. More fruit than this is more savory. I mean, I think those are probably the two biggest. Although
theirs is cleaner too. They have a more controlled process of fermentation. So
is Perry a certain type of pear? Can you call all pear ciders Perry? Or is Perry supposed to be a certain type of tree?
It generally is a specific type of pear that you generally would not be able to eat out of hand. They tend to be small and tannic and actually have a fair amount of acidity to them, which dessert pears have almost no acidity and very little tannin. I mean, they tend to just be a sweet fruit bomb dessert pears. So it is true that these... Perry is sort of a separate fruit from the dessert pear. Having said that, I do have, Honey Sweet and Seckle goes a little bit in here, but it's a relatively small percentage. And those are actually Old American dessert pears, but they're very small. So there's a lot of skin to flesh ratio. I mean, they're not a big... And what I found, too, is when you ferment them out, even by themselves, there's something left. A lot of the dessert pears, when you ferment out, There's pretty much nothing left. There's no flavor, no sort of nose when you ferment those out. You don't want to ferment Bartlett's. It's not.
I find this Perry truly unique. I mean, and vastly different from any other Perry or Poiré that I've ever had. I would say typically a Perry or a Poiré is going to be very floral and aromatic, and there tends to be a little bit of residual sugar traditionally, and this is nothing like that. And I was wondering if you could sort of speak to the process that would get us something which is a lot more akin to, a Spanish cider in a way, or even a Basque cider.
And I think that just goes back to, once again, my techniques. I mean, I think it does have to do with my varietal selection in the orchard itself. So I do have, a decent mix of Perry pears. But as far as once they come into the cidery, we sweat the pears, but for a shorter amount of time, which is actually when you pick the fruit, you let it sit off, and it continues to ripen off the tree. So we sweat it for the maximum amount of time before they actually start to rot. And once again with the pear, we grind the fruit, and pear is a little riskier than cider because the pH and the acid sometimes doesn't work out as well. But we let it sit for 24 to 48 hours, the pumice, before we press. And that's pretty typical for what I do, and I think that's different than almost anyone else, where they grind it and they press it immediately. And it's a different product. There's biochemical reactions happening when you're just letting that pumice sit. And I believe, and the fact that we're doing natural fermentations as opposed to adding cultured yeast and enzymes and all the things that you know a lot of folks use, I think that's what gives it that. I really don't know. I just make it and it comes out this.
Andy Brennan from Aaron Burr, Andy Brennan and Polly Garagosian, they make a peri from foraged pears, actually, from foraged peri pears.
I have no idea. Who knows?
But it they also don't use commercial yeast, so and nor do they filter. So I feel like there's. If there's any similarity between anybody else doing a peri in New York, I would say with those guys.
Cheers. How long are the pears and apples sweated for before they're pressed?
It really depends on the season, because obviously...
That's not a good, isn't it? I like that.
The early September ones you can't let sit. It's too warm. So, you know, for the pears, it could be anywhere from 5 days to 2 weeks. It's a much shorter time. And the apples... could be anywhere from 3 weeks to 2 months, 3 months.
How much loss of mass is there, of water mass?
You know, I've never actually weighed it, but it's considerable. I mean, I would guess, you know, it could be anywhere from 10 to 20%, you know, up to 20 when I let it sit for months. And I also should say, when we sweat them, we do it in a traditional European way where I do not sweat them in a cooler. These are sweat, you know, they're left in the shade, in a shaded barn, essentially, but there's no refrigeration. So these really are continuing to do all the processes of
It tastes that way. I mean, it's like old world ciders, definitely. Yeah.
How did you learn how to do, I mean, it's not like there was such a long tradition here, a continuous one anyway, so how did you learn how to do all this?
I spent a lot of time in the cider regions in Europe, just... You know, visiting and touring. I mean, once again, my wife will tell you that those are the vacations for the last 15 years that I've made her go on is to various cider regions of the world.
So
and
you make cider pilgrimages instead of vacations.
It's uh-huh. And she doesn't complain generally, but no, she's great about it. But yeah, we did a lot of touring, and I would talk with people and. Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, I made as a home cider maker for many years, and, you know, I made a lot of small experimental batches and sort of figured out what worked and what.
What are some of the regions that you traveled to?
Oh, I think I've been to most of the European ones. I mean, I haven't been, so, I mean, I've been to, you know, most of the French regions and England.
Like Normandy.
But, I mean, where I really... The regions I love the most are northern Spain. I mean, I love the Basque region, but even more I love Asturias. That's really where, when I went to Asturias, I realized, no, I really want to make cider.
Is it the culture, too?
It's like, the culture.
It's the whole thing?
Oh, my God. It's great. I mean, you know, it's a very blue-collar part of Spain, and it's beautiful. I mean, it's almost like Ireland. It's green, rolling hills, and it's, you know, dairy and cider, you know, is basically the two main industries. They have more cheese, I've been told, varieties of cheese in Asturias than anywhere else in Europe. Just mainly because each hill, you know, community has their own varieties. But yeah, it's a culture. I mean, you know, you go out to these bars and the whole family's there. There's kids, there's, you know, the parents, the grandparents, they're all drinking cider. You know, they're eating small tapas food. You know,
How do they serve their cider?
They do a high pour. So they essentially pour, these are generally still ciders. They pour it high into a glass. Mm-hmm. It almost looks like a pint glass, but it's actually a little bit thinner, the glass. And they catch it, sort of introduces oxygen and sort of opens up the cider. And then generally you throw it down. So it's you know, a couple sips in a glass. You would throw it down. And in some of the old traditional places, they just have one glass, and they pass it around. There could be 10 or 12 of you sort of drinking out of this, you know, same glass. And you know, it's a great. I mean, that there's
so
a lot of
they just keep coming in high pouring.
They just keep, you know, there's a couple people, you know, essentially bartenders that they pour for you, and the whole place is sticky and messy because it's spilled everywhere. They have troughs usually by the bar, and they hose everything down.
So you have your cider drinking clothes. You know,
you should bring your cider drinking. I don't know if the you know if the owners of those establishments give clothing allowances to them, they should, or at least launder them or something. But no, I loved it, and even you know it's a big mining area too, or it used to be. I mean, the mining is starting to go away because it's cheaper in Eastern Europe and other parts of the world. But I you know met a lot of folks that I mean those guys before they went off the mine would drink a bottle of Sidra. I mean, that was for breakfast with their food, you know, and they would kill a bottle and then they'd go off to the mine and go to work. And it would be great. I'm not saying that we should drink a bottle of cider for breakfast, but that culture would be great in the U.S. Well,
what are we doing right now? That's right.
We advocate. I would say we should. But.
Because you can.
Yeah. So this is what you guys made of, what's up, having cider for breakfast?
That's nice.
Well, I don't
if water systems are contaminated, it would be the best thing to drink. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's low in alcohol and it's refreshing.
That's true.
So then you said you don't brew, you ferment or whatever, but now you got a dry hop cider and pictures of hops on the bottle. This is pretty different than the other ones.
This is different, and this one is also quite different than the 13. This is the 2014. It does have more American hops, and these are all our own hops. I grew hops just for fun because I just love growing things. And we generally, I made beer. I used to make like small batches of beer, and I'd give them to other home brewers and things like that. And then I eventually started to experiment with, you know, a hop cider. I think this one is, because it's more American hops in there, it to me is a little bit more like some of the West Coast hop ciders that have come out, because it does seem to be big out there because that's the big hop growing region in Oregon, Washington State. And 2013 it was quite different because I had more English noble hops in there. And this year, once again, I think the crop looks good for the English noble hops, but it's just another thing that I probably shouldn't have planted because I just have probably too many different things planted.
Yeah, last year's was much more like more floral and more like there's a lot richer in body to it, like as well. Itself. This is much more kind of fresh and floral and citrus, and more citrus and light. And
yeah,
but it's also the hops are delicate and integrated, which is. I think I disagree with you in that about comparing it to West Coast hopped ciders. I think most of the hopped ciders that I've ever tasted have been really kind of full-on hoppy bitter, and this is just balances out, and the hops actually disguise themselves as tannins and flavor. So it's
that's exactly what I was thinking. It's a great flavor profile. Let's jump over to the wassail list. So, so who's buying the cider for wassail? Is it all you now?
Yeah, it's all me.
So let's talk through the list a little bit. Okay. There's some pretty cool stuff on here.
Yeah. A lot of stuff is based... So we have some really cool things on here right now. It changes constantly. We do about 100 bottles of cider on our big list. And generally around 12 or so by draft, and about 5 to 6 by the glass any given day. We get a lot of cool stuff from a lot of people. Steve Wood at Farnham Hill always sends us down whatever he has... chilling out. We have like some older bottles of older kegs of 2013 bittersweets. I have some single varietal Yarnson Mills downstairs that is waiting to get tapped. We also get some other cool stuff like these guys in Barkside are brand new producers up in Williamson of Long Lake, Ontario. This is their varietal crabs. It's like mostly like Wixen and Manchurian crabs. They just got launched a few months ago. I think we're their first wholesale account in New York.
Eve's Cider's making a wassail summer blend.
Yeah, Eve's basically came to us before we opened and said, hey, we have this extra tank of stuff. Would you like some of it? And we're like, yes, we would. So when they came down, like, do you want to make it still or sparkling? We're like, I kind of like it still. It tastes really amazing because it's got so much body and texture to the whole thing. So we took it. It's great. I think they sell it. We take it, and they also pour it at the Kermit Lake Cider House as well.
That's a really fun one when people are new to cider that I bring in here and I'm like, what do you like, beer or wine? And they're like, wine. I say red wine, white wine. You know, if they come down to the I like white wine, I give them a glass of that, and they're like, oh, did you get me wine? I'm like, no.
Oh, wait, let's have some fun. So we're going to take a short break. We're back in a few minutes. We're going to do some fun teaching me how to drink cider at Wassail Stories. All right, back in a few minutes.
Wah, wah, wah. Wah, wah.
You're listening to Train Song by the California Honey Drops.
Cider Week helps to bring profitability to local orchards while reviving heirloom apple varieties by cultivating awareness of craft cider. Cider Week connects cider makers from New York State and select pioneering guest cideries outside the state to buyers from top restaurants, bars, and retail shops across New York City. Those culinary tastemakers, in turn, help increase consumer awareness of cider's pleasures by hosting public events, tastings, dinners, classes, and pairings that build appreciation and demand for regional ciders.
Hey, we're Cloud Control. And you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio, a special on location at Wassail Cider House, New York City. Ben Sandler, Dan Pucci, Sabine Rutsch. And John Rells from Black Duck Cidery and Gan K from United States of Cider. So we're having some fun. We're going to start talking about how do you teach people about cider. So Sabine, you were saying if I like a white wine but I never really had ciders, what should I try when I come?
Yeah, I think it's still, dry, crisp, generally, an American style.
But some of the ciders you have here, what I don't even know half these ciders, so...
Definitely things like the ease.
Drink if I like white wine.
The crab apple cider we have as well.
I think tastes like a Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah,
it's like
super high toned and acid. Yeah.
I think a real boundary pusher is the Imperial Rosé that we have.
Oh yeah,
we love playing with these blurred lines between cider and wine, and this particular one with its high alcohol and the fact that it's sparkling and pink, it really masks itself as a sparkling rosé.
And that's from Eden.
That's Eden.
Wow, I've never even heard of that. Did she make it just for you guys?
No, she sells it at a couple of places too. She just made it this year though. She
asked Albert
for.
She was like, "I want a rosé,"
and he made her. And he made her a rosé.
And then let's say like if I want a beer, say I like beer instead of wine, then what would you ask me next if I wanted to try a cider?
Which beer do you want?
I want like it's a nice pale ale. I want like a nice, easy drinking pale ale.
I think you ask for things. I think you might find some ciders that have more of a yeasty quality to them, more of a leesy quality. I think some of the more the English styles that have more of that kind of that texture and that body can work really well for something like that. Like the Sanford Orchards.
Yeah.
Or this really cool German one, the Fuschhof, which is.
I've never heard of Sanford. So that's from
they're
the UK.
They're in Devonshire. They're all like super old school English cider. Right now I have the Ashen Bitter and Dabinet, which is like leathery and full and meaty. And I get that from people like red wine and things like that, or more kind of savory, more bitter beers because it's pretty earthy and pretty big in texture.
And what if I wanted a red wine? Like I'm just like a red wine drinker. I like a full bodied red wine.
It depends on what you're looking for in that red wine.
Yeah.
Is it the tannins?
Well, is it like? And I want earthy and tannic.
I think
French.
I think I think some of John ciders as well, kind of fall into that same line of like. I always remember I'm trying to talk about John ciders. I would say like, I would call the Perrier like, hey, this is like cool Chenin Blanc. It's always mine. Like this has got texture and meat and like weight to it. And I think the ciders as well are really.
Yeah.
These ciders that have that more of that acid, that more tannin backbone. Are really great for anyone who wants like red wines or kind of more savory beers or savory.
Yeah, we forget sometimes that people are just learning about beverages and and come from college and you've had certain things and come to a place like Wassail, you want to learn. So,
and yeah. We even have the like if somebody just has only drank the more commercial like really really sweet stuff, we will steer them towards maybe a type of French Perry that tends to be very very high in the residual sugar. So there's the sweetness there, but it's a natural byproduct of the process. It's not by the fact that they added sugar. So that's kind of like the gateway. Yeah.
Cider's tough. I have a funny story. Last year, I met some really cool English guys, and they were here in New York doing some events. And so they came by one night and said, I heard you guys have really good ciders. And we tried them all. We didn't like them. I said, well, wait a minute. I'll get this Aaron Burr cider that no one has, and they tried to say, nope, we don't like that. And I said, what do you guys really drink in England? And they said Magners. And then I was like, you know what? These guys have nothing on us. And I'll tell you, the American cider scene and the New York cider scene is pretty cool. Because we can talk about these great ciders, and they have no idea what we're talking about. Forget England. But you, do you have some funny stories like that? You must have customers that come in and...
Yeah, people are really... our customers really want to try a really new... We've still been some folks who come in here who are very experienced and, like, love cider and all these things. And maybe that is that Magners, that commercial product. Maybe it's more that interesting small production. Maybe it hasn't farm hill before and things like that. But most customers here are pretty new. They kind of want to try stuff. You know, they're more experienced in terms of, like, they're, like, very hardcore beer drinkers, or they're wine experts, or whatever it happens to be. They're still pretty new to cider, and they're really here to try stuff. And we can really, like, be a gateway to try new, interesting things. People want to try as much stuff as possible. And try and push, like, really want to try something, like, so interesting. I like a guy last night, like, I want to try something really, really cool. What's the nerdiest thing I have right now? So I poured him a glass of John's Perry last night. And he's like, wow, this is crazy. I'm like, yeah, it's pretty crazy. It's pretty crazy.
Awesome. Do you offer flights? Like, if somebody wants to come in and they have never had cider in their life?
We're gonna start offering flights soon. We do a little bit of one right now. We didn't really do it in the beginning, but now we're doing more so of that. Because there definitely has been demand for people wanting to try. Mm-hmm. Like, people really want to try tons of stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's just from an educational standpoint. Like, right. If you've never had cider and you want to try a few things, smaller pours, more of them.
Right.
Get a sense of what you like.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And then tell us more about these. I'm still want to know more about the dinner and tasting format. So, John was here last night. What did you guys do with him, and how was the experience for the customers?
Last night was more casual. Last night was kind of, we had John hang at the bar. We had a bunch of folks come in, kind of chat and talk with him.
So he sits at the bar?
Yeah, and people kind of come in. We did a takeover last night, so it was all him by the glass. Generally on those nights, we have always kind
of like... One, two, three. We had six of his ciders last night?
Yeah, six of his ciders last night.
List.
And people come in, they talk, and they kind of chill out. It's kind of very casual, relaxed, and people get to learn and talk and drink and have a fun time. We also do dinners as well. We're going to do dinner with John probably in wintertime after a fruit tea, after he's done on the farm, which are more like, sit down, we do like a 20-person dinner, which are more kind of...
So you have a room in the back? Is that where you do the dinners?
Room in the back.
It's a nice...
We're trying to do at least one or two of those a month. We're doing one probably end of August or next one. We're still trying to pin it down right now.
And what will the format be for the dinner?
The format for the dinner is basically our chef kind of creates a 4 to 5 course menu. I go through, we basically pair one cider for each of the courses. Usually we find some really cool produce to highlight to it as well. Either be stuff from the producer's farm, because most of the time they're fairly local, or something, and we basically kind of, me and the producer have a good time, we kind of talk back and forth, we have a good conversation with the guests, and we can kind of really get the entire, all 25 guests or so involved in conversation. They kind of leave really excited about cider, and they've gotten to try stuff they've never had before. And we get usually bring down like really cool bottles of like one-off things. Like, this is a weird thing we made 3 years ago, and it's like amazing. We've had people...
we've had producers. Well, that's kind of like what you just opened up. What is this? It's like a jug of cider.
It is a jug of cider. So this is actually a very light cider. It's a cider that we actually took a press, essentially low bricks press from ice cider experiment. And this was down to like 7 or 8 bricks. This is sort of what's left after you take out the high brick stuff to actually make like an ice cider. And so that's why I call it kind of the kin, because people used to take, after they pressed apples, they would then add water to the pumice and then re-extract and get a very low alcohol cider. And that's sort of what the workers then would drink. So in the orchard while they're working, it's low alcohol, refreshing.
And you don't add anything like sugar or
There's never sugar fresh added. Juice. But this then I actually added sea berries. So we grow some amount of sea berries, which is Hippophaea rhamnoides. And yeah, there is some in there, because this is actually not a cider that we will commercially bottle. This is for us to drink in the field. It's low alcohol. It's about 3% alcohol. And
so you have to have a whole jug for breakfast.
There's your breakfast.
Well, it's a half a jug for breakfast, a half for lunch. We go a little bit easy on it. But, yeah, so this is more of a cider for us to drink. I don't know if I would ever bottle this, but I told, Dan that I would bring down a couple interesting things, and this was one that I brought down. But we grow sea berries. I mean, it's a fruit that's sort of endemic to Central Asia and into Russia and Siberia. And for all the sort of mythology geeks out there, the sea berries are what a Pegasus needed to eat to be able to fly. So I know there's probably a lot of Greek mythology.
Oh, our pastry chef's gonna people.
But and basically all so
there's
the
there's Greek gods hanging up in the Finger Lakes.
They're
working the fields with their shirts off, drinking jugs of this.
That would be great.
That's a great tourism ad.
All the towns are already named after all the towns that are already named after Greek towns already.
They are. True that we're Romulus and Ovid. Romulus. I mean it's Ovid,
Homer,
but they changed it. But yeah, we have a lot of Greek. Apparently, the guy, the cartographer, when they were making the maps and naming towns in upstate New York, at least in our area in the Finger Lakes, was obsessed with Greek literature and ancient Greek history, and so that's why he just started picking names for towns, so Romulus and Ovid and all this stuff. So yeah, it's fitting that we would have a light sea berry cider. So
what's a typical day for you, man? I mean, you talk about stewardship of the land and you're planting trees for the future.
Well, they're long days, and we do. I do have two young children, so there's a lot of that involved too, of just sort of the family life. But I will say that Black Duck is not just me. It is, like we like to say, the Black Duck crew. My wife clearly to put up with me all these years of planting these things is amazing. And then we have a lot of really great help that work for us. So it's not just me, but I mean, it's 7 days a week that we work. I do go to market myself on Saturday. We do Ithaca Farmers Markets. I do tastings. We sell fresh fruit and all this. But pretty much 7 days a week in season, we work. I mean, I get up, I take care. We have a huge flock of ducks that we raise for duck eggs. So that's usually the first thing I do in the morning. I get up, I take care of the ducks, I come in, I drink coffee, a lot of coffee, and then breakfast, and then I either I'm picking or helping pick, we're trellising, in the winter we prune trees. I mean, there's never completely a downtime, but in winter it's a lot less work because it mainly revolves around pruning, and then. We actually graft most of our own trees. So there's a lot of that work in the winter. So that's actually when you essentially, make a new tree. You take a rootstock, you put the top part on, which is the part that you want, the variety you want, and you essentially make a new tree. So there's a lot of that.
What's your biggest fear? Like you're a farmer and orchardist based on the land, there's nature. What's your biggest fear or a big fear that you have to think about every year?
Well, or weather. Summer. I mean, it's all about Mother Nature because she dictates everything. Crop loss is really through weather, is really our biggest fear. I mean, in 2012, there was a very early push on the fruit trees. It got very, very warm in February and March. Things bloomed much too early. And then we had severe frost. Most of the Finger Lakes people lost sometimes everything. There was no apples and pears that year. I actually was out in the orchard all five nights burning fires, essentially small fires to create an inversion layer. It's not the heat from the fire itself, but the heat goes up and it essentially goes, it starts to go into the atmosphere 30, 50 feet up, and it creates a convection where you bring warm air down from 40 to 50 feet up, and I was able to save about 40% of my crop that year. But that was five nights all night long running around tending small fires. Weather is always the biggest thing. I mean, we've had two relatively cold severe winters in a row here in the Finger Lakes, so And it's something you really can't control. I mean, I can't, you know, tell Mother Nature to stop bringing the cold. Or, and we've had, you know, a lot of rain this early summer, which was relatively okay. If we get that rain in the fall, that's a problem. You know, it starts to wash out the fruit. You know, you get a lot of water down, crops. Although I will say the grape people are more at risk in the Finger Lakes, which is, you know, a huge industry, the Finger Lakes wine industry. And if they get fall rains, they're much more susceptible to rot and other things, not just sort of a watered down fruit, but, they have issues with no harvest then. So, if I could control nature, that would really be helpful. If you can figure out a way to...
There's a company called Tropicana, but I don't know about that. Who wants to ask one last question? Because this is so much information. It's pretty cool. Go ahead. Kay and then Ben, so we can do two questions.
We have time for both. For John, so you've made cider pilgrimages. Is there a cider pilgrimage? What's the next cider pilgrimage on your list that you would like to make?
Specific region.
Yeah, well, I'm obsessed with Disturius. I mean, I haven't actually... found out all about that region. I want to go back and spend more time. It's actually not a very big area, but I don't feel that I've, sort of taken it all in. So I think, I have a daughter that's 16 months old, so we're not ready to go back yet. We want probably wait another year or so, but I'm going to go back to Asturias. Yeah.
Ben,
I was just going to ask, I mean, clearly, like, your fruit, your process and your farm are very, very important to you. And I think that these are really integral issues for defining what American cider is, too, because there's a lot of people focusing on the terroir and wanting to, be as minimalist as possible and that the fruit say what it says for that region. There's a lot of people that buck that and just go all about process. So like, we're going to stop... the fermentation, inoculate it, and treat it with a particular yeast, and add adjuncts and do whatever we do, but we're going to make something great just the same.
Sure.
So I want to know from you what you think what's the direction of American cider? Which way are we going? Is it sort of all of it at the same time? Because other regions have very specific styles.
I think that, if I look at the wine industry sort of as a guide, and I think it's obviously more mature than the American cider industry, which is, sort of in its infancy, the rebirth of it at least. I think both ways. I don't particularly see one of those sort of, being the main choice of the majority of people. And I think that's sort of great in one way. I love the European cider regions and wine regions, but they are relatively locked in, either through laws or just tradition, to a very specific set, whether it's varieties or the processing or techniques. And I kind of like that we're a little bit, like the Wild West, where anything can go, and then it's a matter of your taste. I had this discussion with someone last night here at the bar. I have no problem with Angry Orchard or some of these bigger cider makers if they're using real apples. I think there's a place for that, too, for someone's taste. I might not necessarily want to drink those ciders, but, it definitely could be a gateway for people where they start that way. And, yeah, I have no problem with any of those stuff.
You guys are – there's a quote from your website that Gay gave me. It says, we let the fruit speak for itself, and variation from season to season should be expected in the finished beverages. So cheers to you guys.
Cheers.
And I will say, just on that note, like, we've interviewed Reverend Nat from Oregon, and he's talking about just using the bounty of, regular dessert apples in his state. And then you've got – a Kevin Z from Easy Orchards who's growing his own, That's just in one state, there's two different guys, totally different approaches. And I think that you guys are onto something. I'm so proud of you guys at Wassail. It's like every week you're bringing in the best people in the world for cider right here on Orchard Street. And can't wait to see what you guys do for Cider Week New York City. All right. I'd like to thank our sponsors at Union Beer Distributors, who helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. Thanks to West Sales, Ben Sandler, Daniel, and Sabine, and cider maker John Reynolds from Black Duck Cidery for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to Gay and Kay from United States of Cider and our engineer, Jack Inslee. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Yeah. Woo!
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.